The hit Netflix series, La Casa de Papel, which many of you know as Money Heist, was a fictitious story about one of the world's most daring robberies. But something like that couldn't happen in real life, could it? On January 12, 2006, six men walked into the Banco Río de Acassuso in Buenos Aires, Argentina, armed with guns and a bold plan. Led by a charismatic man who thought himself an artist, they walked in, some in costume, and walked out without firing a shot or hurting any of the hostages inside. And they did this while an over 200-member tactical response team was waiting to breach the entrance. The cops finally did get in, but when they did, they got a big surprise. And the story only gets stranger from there. This is our newest story on the Mysteries of Latin America podcast, where we'll tell you the details of the operation, how they planned it, the police investigation, the arrests, if any, if authorities got any money back, and the mysteries that still surround this epic heist that people in Argentina today call the robbery of the century. My name is Andrew Colon, and what we do here is tell stories about the myths, legends, mysteries, and history of Latin America so we know our own stories, and so people all over the world can know about some of what makes the cultures of North, Central, South America, and the Caribbean what they are today. If it's your first time with us, welcome. And if you're a returning listener, I really appreciate you coming back, and I invite all of you to share, subscribe, and follow the podcast however you're catching it, and to let your like-minded friends and family know about it. Little by little, or poco a poco, as we might say down here, we're building a community, and I'm honored to be a part of it. Now let's get to today's story of the real money heist. It was September of 2004. A 36-year-old visual artist and martial artist and an artist at growing and consuming cannabis named Fernando Araujo, well, Fernando got an idea in his head during a year he considers to be a sabbatical, where he spent the year engrossed in all of his arts. And that idea was that he was going to rob a bank. He didn't know the how, when, or where, but he knew it had to be done, and done artistically. And the idea wouldn't leave him alone. It soon became time to find a target. And after searching, he found one. A branch of the Banco Río Bank in the Buenos Aires suburb of Acassuso. His idea, as I said before, was to rob the bank artistically, which to Araujo meant without violence. He felt he had two scenarios to consider. To rob it during the day, which meant guns and the possibility of violence, and silent alarms and little chance of success, or to do it at night, going into the bank's vault through an underground tunnel. But that would mean facing sophisticated security systems and other risks. On top of that, to have any chance of success, he'd have to assemble a team. He confided in an old schoolmate named Sebastián García, who was skilled at all things technical and was great with mechanical tools, so much so that his nickname was El Ingeniero, the engineer. But while Sebastián had never committed a crime, he knew that his family had suffered and lost much of their savings with banks during Argentina's financial crisis, so he felt a sense of justification in robbing a bank. Sebastián was in. The idea was to rent a house close to the bank, dig a tunnel that would get under the bank's vault, and drill through its walls and its contents. Both men worked whenever they could for months, planning, observing the bank, its facilities, and its security systems, and even went so much as to design suits that could possibly throw off bank sensors. But one day, after all this planning, Fernando Araujo started seeing the robbery as absolutely impossible. So he canceled all of the plans. There was no way they could pull this off. But then one day, with a little help from diving into an internet rabbit hole of robberies, and perhaps some inspiration from his artistically cultivated cannabis, Fernando Araujo had an epiphany. They could mix both day and night scenarios. A heist mashup, if you will. They would enter the bank during the day, rob the vault, and use a tunnel, not to get in, but to get away. It had never been done before. Araujo recruited Sebastián once again, and both started studying and measuring the area in depth now, learning about the soil conditions and water and sewer connections. And when they did that, they discovered a vast underground web of vile, dirty, enormous sewer tunnels, just right for the phase of the enterprise Fernando would call the Donatello Project. You know, after the Ninja Turtles. Now they would need more help and investment, as resources were in short supply and there were things to buy. They recruited someone who would be known as Doc, an attorney by training, but he was someone who definitely knew the world of crime very well. Doc, in turn, brought in a new cohort to the caper, a man named Beto, a career criminal. But they still needed more money and more help. For that, Doc brought in another acquaintance we'll call Vitete, because it was his last name. Another career criminal, adept at breaking into safes, and with some money to invest in the caper. Now it was time to brave the stench of the sewer and dig. And the group got together, using pneumatic drills, jackhammers, and other tools to do it over the course of months. And no one topside was the wiser. And then one day, they reached the walls of the vault. With the addition of a new accomplice they would call El Nene, the infant, their crew was complete, and now they would wait for the right moment. On January 13th, 2006, at 12:20 p.m., four men walked into Banco Rio, one dressed in a gray suit and the other in an apron and a wig. They were Doc and Beto. Sebastian was in the underground shaft they had dug, leading to the bank. 20 minutes later, Vitete and El Nene also entered through different doors. The men were in position and ready to go. Within minutes, and without firing a shot from their very convincing toy guns, the bank's customers and employees were subdued. The bank's chief security officer was in a bunker down in the basement and was watching the situation unfold via security cameras, and he immediately alerted the Argentine federal police, who were now on the way. The clock was ticking. Minutes later, Fernando Araujo, the leader, entered the bank wearing a loose jacket and a cap. By 12:50 p.m., less than an hour later, the situation had now become breaking news in Argentinian media, reporting the break-in and the taking of a total of 23 hostages. Araujo walked out with a hostage, but then he saw approaching police and made sure they saw him, and he went back into the bank with the hostage. With the hostages taken and the bank secured, it was time to get the bank's main security officer out of his bunker, as he was the one communicating with the outside world and also the closest to the bank's vault. But he was refusing to come out, despite threats made to him and the bank's manager by Vitete. He finally gave in. In a bizarre twist, he became the first hostage to be released. Of course, after Vitete made sure he left his gun and his phone behind. Now the person in charge of communicating with the police was Vitete, who had taken acting classes to prepare for the conversation. He spoke with them via the guard's phone and was dubbed by the press as the man in the gray suit and leader. 4 hours later, at 4:30 p.m., Vitete contacted the police asking for food and drink, telling him they probably wouldn't eat for a long time because they would be surrendering to the police, as the whole thing had gone horribly wrong and they just wanted a peaceful end to the situation where no one got hurt. The police sent for the food. Around 7 p.m., a hostage called her sister, who was outside the bank, and said they hadn't heard any noise from the thieves for several minutes, which prompted the Halcón, the Falcon, Special Security Division, Argentina's tactical response team, to storm the bank, only to find that the gang was gone and there was no sign of them. And an hour and a half later, at 8:30 p.m., they did find a sign, literally. Behind a cabinet that was used to cover the entrance to their escape tunnel, leader Fernando Araujo left a sign poetically taunting the police. The hand-stenciled sign read in Spanish, "En barrio de ricachones, sin armas ni rencores, es solo plata y no amores." In the neighborhood of the rich, without weapons or grudges. It's only money and not love. Police attempted to go into the tunnel, but there was a surprise waiting for them, a booby-trap bomb. 2 hours later, though, the bomb squad determined that it was also a fake. But now let's rewind a bit and see what was going on between the time that Bitete, aka the man in the gray suit, asked for pizzas and sodas, and when the cops stormed the bank. Well, even before that, Araujo and his team had studied police protocol and memorized their manuals. They had police scanners and walkie-talkies to listen in on calls and even monitor the tactical response team. And they knew exactly how they would behave in hostage situations and used that to their advantage to buy time. By the time they had asked for food, the robbers had already jackhammered into the bank's vault, opened 143 safety deposit boxes using a hydraulic piston Sebastian had made, and the request gave them time to escape down through the tunnel and out through the drain. The team lowered the money through the hole they'd made in the wall and down a ladder. When they got down the tunnel and once in the sewer tunnels, they loaded the money onto two inflatable boats. From there, they traveled underground and transferred the bags from the drain into another tunnel that led straight up and into a waiting van parked over an open manhole with a hole cut in the floor of the van where a new accomplice, El Paisa, would be waiting for them as their getaway driver. After loading all the bags, they headed to a common location to distribute their haul. According to Araujo, their real leader, when they arrived at the secret location to divide up the money, they turned on the television, just in time to watch a live broadcast of the tactical team storming the bank. After the escape and distribution of the money by the thieves, they separated and headed in different directions with the intention of never seeing or hearing from each other ever again. 1 month after the robbery, one of the gang was the first to be arrested. That was Beto, after a falling out with his wife over the money, but there's also the story out there that Beto had another woman and that he planned to run away with her and the money. His now ex-wife, Alicia, reached out to the police and they arrested him and found $700,000 in a bag. Alicia, who had witnessed the group work on the van, provided police with at least the nicknames and descriptions of the other criminals, and they began raiding and arresting the members one by one. Within weeks of Beto's arrest, Sebastian was arrested, where he immediately confessed his participation in the robbery. Upon learning of Sebastian's arrest, Vitete, our man in the suit, whom everyone thought was the real ringleader, was living in Uruguay when he received a call from Doc, another perpetrator, saying that Beto's wife was trying to blackmail him for $300,000 to not betray the other robbers. With that news, Vitete felt the noose tighten and decided to turn himself in, as he knew the ins and outs of the Argentinian justice system, as he had already spent time in jail there. And he agreed to a shortened trial and was initially sentenced to 21 years and 6 months in prison. Initially, Fernando Araujo, the real leader, escaped to the mountains of San Juan, Argentina, but was tracked down and found in a tent and arrested there by the Argentine National Military Police. And shortly after being booked and processed, four men, Beto, Fernando, Sebastian, and El Paisa, the driver, but not including Vitete, who had surrendered and was already serving his sentence, were promptly released pending trial. That trial finally happened on February 15, 2010, 4 years after the event. Despite their four-year break, all four men were found guilty as charged and, depending on their participation in the crime, were sentenced to between 9 and 15 years in prison. Initially. I say initially because their sentences were appealed, and upon appeal, these sentences were reduced when a higher court found errors in the first trial, because they were found to have not used real guns, and because none of the hostages were injured, their convictions would have to be lowered to reflect the less violent nature of their crimes. After these adjustments were made to their sentences, they ended up spending between 18 months and 8 years in prison and were released upon completing They're now shortened sentences. And where are these men today? Fernando Araujo was the leader of the heist. After spending only a year and a half in prison, today he remains passionate about his art and extreme sports like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and Karate, and also participates in international conferences related to the growing and culture of cannabis. Sebastian Garcia Bolster, the man responsible for the technical and mechanical side of the heist, spent about 4 years in jail. Today, he has a small workshop in Buenos Aires where he fixes cars and motorcycles and watercraft. Luis Mario Vitete Sellanes, known as Vitete, was known to the police and the press as the man in the gray suit, and they thought he was the mastermind, as he kept the police and tactical team busy while the rest robbed the vault and got away. Today he spends his days in Uruguay, where he owns a jewelry business, and he also wrote a book about the crime called The Thief of the Century. Ruben Alberto de la Torre, also known as Beto, spent 8 years in federal prison. He lives today as a retiree. If you remember, it was his now ex-wife who betrayed him to investigators because she thought he might flee with his share of the loot and a younger lover. Julian Sayo Echevarria, alias El Paisa, was the driver of the crew. He also spent 8 years in prison, and today he's a free man. His dream is to open a restaurant or bar themed around the heist of the century. After the heist and while waiting for the trial, he also ended up studying and getting a law degree. The four men also received an undisclosed sum of money for participating in a Netflix documentary about the heist. Additionally, several of the men received a significant payment for their appearance and the use of their image in a movie called The Robbery of the Century. So now you might be wondering, but that's only four of the six men, right? The men known as Doc, the attorney, and El Nene were never charged, as their identities could never be confirmed and their alibis held up. The Doc is still a practicing attorney today, and oftentimes defends criminals pro bono. El Nene, the infant, is actually 64 years old, if he's still alive, but his whereabouts are completely unknown. What is known is that shortly after the robbery, his friends say he mysteriously bought not one, not two, but three Ford Rangers, with three drivers to boot, as he didn't have a license. And not long after that, he disappeared. Friends aren't sure if he's dead or if he's in jail. Some say he might be in jail for unrelated crimes, possibly even in Italy. But no one knows for sure. What about the elephant in the room? I know you're asking the same question I have on my mind. What happened to the money? Where is the money? What is known is that the thieves fled the Banco Rio de Acasuso in a raft and carried bags containing between, the police, the bank, and even the criminals have all given different numbers, between $15 and $19 million that they split up according to each one's perceived contribution to the heist. However, the police only managed to recover $1 million, mostly from Beto's take when he was turned in by his wife. A journalist close to the story, named Rodolfo Palacios, has deduced that it's likely that the money is held up in properties, that much of it has already been laundered and is back in the banking system legally, and is hidden away in shell companies and offshore banks. So if you saw the series Money Heist, instead of their names being Tokyo, Denver, Berlin, and the professor, they were Araujo, Vitete, Beto, and Doc, and they pulled off Argentina's heist of the century. Yes, they were later arrested. And yes, they spent time in jail. But today they're free men. They've even been able to profit from their crimes by freely telling and selling their story, saying that yes, they did it. And when asked about what happened to the money, they just laugh the question off or say they don't know. Now, I found this story when initially another heist, but this time in Brazil, caught my attention and reminded me of La Casa de Papel, or Money Heist, if you caught the version in English. Please don't ask me what I thought about the dubbed version into English. La Casa de Papel follows the plan of a mysterious man known as the Professor, who rounds up a group of skilled criminals to carry out an ambitious heist on the Royal Mint of Spain, The plan involved taking hostages at the mint and printing billions of euros over the course of 11 days. Ultimately, they escape by executing a meticulously orchestrated plans with decoys, tunnels, and clever strategies to outsmart law enforcement and flee with their lives and the money. Now, the heist at the Banco Rio de Acassuso only lasted a few hours and not 11 days. I'd say that some of the similarities are uncanny coincidences. And Money Heist even featured an Argentinian character named Palermo in that heist. Coincidence? The producers of Money Heist deny any direct inspiration from the Banco Rio heist, which happened in 2006, saying that they were inspired by classic heist films and other real-world events. The first season of Money Heist was first produced in 2017 by Spanish network Antena 3 and gained international popularity after being picked up by Netflix, and it quickly became one of the platform's most popular and widely watched non-English language series. I guess we can just chalk it up to a case of art imitating life. Latin America can be a surreal place to live sometimes. After 30 years, the things, both amazing and horrific, that can happen down here never cease to amaze me. And Argentina's robbery of the century, the real money heist, is definitely one of them, and that's the reason it's now in our vault of mystery podcasts. From how the plan came together, how it was carried out, how police were fooled, and how the sentences were mysteriously reduced on appeal, reminds me that it's never a dull moment here in Latin America. I thank you for listening to this episode of the Mysteries of Latin America podcast, where I tell the stories of the myths, legends, mysteries, and history of North, Central, South America, and the Caribbean. I also thank you in advance for sharing, following, and subscribing to the podcast. And if you have ideas for a future episode, please contact me through Spotify, Apple, YouTube, however you're listening to us, or drop us an email at andy@andycancun.com. Friends, my name is Andrew Colon, and from Cancun I say thank you, gracias, and adios.